Iowa Soybean Association is driven to deliver for Iowa's 40,000 soybean farmers. We're proud to provide objective agronomic research, a helping hand with soil and water stewardship, and timely industry news powered by the Soybean Checkoff. Learn more at iasoybeans.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Paul Yeager. It's 2023. Same podcast, different topics, better pizza. I don't know, something like that. I must have watched too many bowl games and too many commercials. And reminder, this podcast is commercial free. This is the MTOM podcast. I'm Paul Yeager. This is a product of Iowa PBS and the Market to Market TV show. We are a nationally distributed show on the PBS system. You can also watch us wherever you want to on the world on YouTube. You know, that might be how you're watching us today. So we do like the national topics. And one of the biggest topics that came out of 22 into 23 is going to be energy. Renewable energy is something we talk about all the time, whether it's ethanol, wind, solar. So why not discuss those topics? We're going to get a southern taste of some things from, say, Tennessee in across to Arkansas. We're also going to talk about Louisiana and Iowa and the state of Texas, which we know is a whole nother discussion in its own right. Our guest today is Simon Mahan. He is with the Southern Renewable Energy Association. He's sitting in Arkansas, so we talk a little bit about there. We'll discuss the weather, of course. And we discuss the topic of energy, what's happening, a couple of interesting stories that he shares about his time in Texas on his energy bill, and a couple of things to look for here in 2023, specifically a couple of states and the projects that they are working on. That is today's MTOM Show Podcast. New episodes each and every Tuesday. If you like us, rate us, share us, tell a friend. That's really what means a lot to me when you share this with a friend and say, hey, I think you'd like it. And I think you're going to like this topic. Here's Simon. Early January is supposed to be what in Arkansas? Because I always think of you in Oklahoma is in this, are you winter or are you not? 40 degrees is considered what in January for you?
Cold. It is preparation for the deep darkness of February that's going to be even worse. December, you know, is supposed to be when winter is supposed to start, but February is what we really dread. So we're going to prepare for the cold in February.
Okay, so you consider February cold, and I get it, it's cold, but to me, I look at it as a daylight thing. When the sun goes down past 5:30, or almost right. 6 o'clock in the end of February, I get more excited. That's right. How I get through it.
That's fair. That's fair.
I mean, what's your LinkedIn profile bio say that your job is?
I am the executive director of the Southern Renewable Energy Association.
What does that mean?
It means I run a trade association of large-scale renewable developers. So we focus on wind, energy storage, solar, hydrogen, transmission, throughout the Southeast, Louisiana, Arkansas, Kentucky, and everywhere south of there. And we mostly focus on regulatory affairs and legislative affairs throughout the region.
And you are tied in, I think, to a larger consortium too?
What do you mean by that?
Well, in terms of there's a larger group that you're, I won't say network, but when it all renewable, there's a group. How many is in your states that you, when you say south, when you say Southern, what does that mean for you? How many states in your group?
Yeah, so we cover, I think it's 7 states. So Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, Tennessee, and Kentucky. But we do try to keep track of all of our neighbors and make sure that what's happening in our neighboring states, the good things happen over here as well. And of course, also anything that's happening at the federal level, we have to keep tabs on what's going on there because it does trickle down to us as well.
Do you have to pay attention more to federal legislation or state-by-state legislation when it comes to all of the different energies that you're a part of?
I really prefer to stick to the state-level stuff. That's where most of the activity happens. What a lot of folks don't know is that a lot of your energy matters, your electric bill issues are really decided from your state decision makers. Your electric companies are often regulated by your state public service commissions, your state public utility commissions, sometimes even your city council members. And so while there's often an awful lot of focus on what's happening in DC inside the Beltway, it's sometimes your state elected officials that are making much more decisions regarding your energy mix in your state than what's happening out in DC. And so we focus almost exclusively on the state regulatory side of things with the public service commissions and more recently with the state legislatures. And often we really just want to make sure that the electric companies are allowing renewable energy resources to compete and embracing the lower cost resources available, because we are seeing the low cost renewables are the cheapest things available to them. So if we can provide those low cost renewables to the utilities, it's often the most economic resources that they can buy.
And I get what you're saying, but I also hear people come onto our show and mention, well, the reason that energy is moving which way or the not is all President Biden. It's because he has set a green agenda and it just is an overall paintbrush. When you hear a comment like that, do you shudder? What do you do?
Yeah, well, it's federal policy. I will say after the Inflation Reduction Act passage of August, everyone was surprised. We don't really anticipate Congress to do anything with regards to energy policy. They really haven't done an awful lot on energy policy really since about 2015. That's the last time that there was major energy legislation passed that really affected us at the federal level. And so since about then, it's all been state level activities. And just this past year, we were kind of counting up the past activities for 2022. And we found that most of the utilities in our region were really focused on the low cost provisions of renewables that were based off of non-federal incentives through the Inflation Reduction Act. And so they were not anticipating what happened in August. And even with that, we were finding that there were about 14,000 megawatts of renewable energy projects that were being scoped out or proposed by the utilities that we work with. And to put that into context for the listeners, our states do not have mandates for renewable energy resources. We're not focused on legislative mandates like places like California or New York, where renewables are required in those states for carbon emission purposes or anything like that. And so our utilities are buying renewables because it's the least cost thing that they can do. And the 14,000 megawatts worth of proposals and requests that the utilities that we've worked with would result in somewhere between $15 to $20 billion worth of economic development in our region. And again, that was all being led well prior to the Inflation Reduction Act and Joe Biden doing anything. So while the federal work is going to help, it was not being led because of the federal activity.
I think you said 14,000 different projects. Is that just among your states?
Well, it's 14,000 megawatts. So
megawatts. Okay.
Yeah. An individual project might be somewhere between 150 to 300 megawatts. So it depends on how big the individual projects are, but it's a considerable amount. You know, had we asked or had someone asked me even 5 years ago how many megawatts we might be getting over the next few years, and someone would say 14,000, I would have been surprised. But it's a testament to how quickly the technology has evolved and the power of private enterprise and the ability to have low-cost energy in our states.
A lot of our audience is very familiar with ethanol. That's mm-hmm. considered one of the older renewables in all of the different forms that you have mentioned. And there's always arguments about, no, the blending level should be here. Then there's a lot of producers who have a wind turbine near them, on their property, around them, whatever it is. But now it seems to be solar was, to me, in a lot of our rural America audience in 2022, solar was the big topic.
Do I have it right in your region too? Is that kind of
Yeah, solar has really started to take a really strong lead. Wind technology, particularly up in the upper Midwest, is still going very strong. Particularly down in the South, we have a very strong solar resource. Our wind resource is less strong, I'll say, than it is in the upper Midwest. We do have a meager wind resource, though. But as we have more solar technology come online, the wind and solar work well together. So if you think about the weather, you tend to have a very strong wind resource during the winter time and at night. And that pairs very well with solar, which works well during the day and during the summertime. And so having those two technologies work together create a more stable grid, and it helps reduce costs all year long. And so that way, users and ratepayers have a more stable bill. And so you're not just relying on one single technology. And then when you start adding batteries into all that, that's when we start getting to a really, really interesting mix.
The stability side is one of the criticisms I think solar and wind get, is that, yes, one doesn't happen all the time. Is that what power companies tell you of, well, we just can't make solar work. It's just too inconsistent. We need something consistent. And I get that. What's the counter to the, I mean, you mentioned part of the discussion already, what the counter is, one with the other. But I mean, what's another way that those, how you can answer that question?
Yeah, so it's really quite incredible, but most of the region that you and I live in, Iowa down here into Arkansas, you and I live in a grid operator called the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, or MISO. And MISO is the grid operator, balances all the different types of power plants, coal, gas, wind, nuclear, solar, on a minute-by-minute basis every hour of every day. And it's really incredible what they're able to do, where they have meteorologists on staff, where they forecast when the wind is going to ramp up, when it's going to go down. And they literally balance the power that is needed for the entire region so that we have stable power. Right next to us is another grid operator called the Southwestern Power Pool, and they actually have headquarters here in Little Rock. And their region covers basically from Oklahoma on up through the Great Plains. And in the Southwestern Power Pool, they have some of the best wind resources in the country. Last year, I think it was in March or in April, there was an hour where they actually reached over 80% of their production was from wind energy. And on an annual basis, they get about 40% of their power from wind energy. And so these major grid operators are able to forecast when these variable generation resources, the wind, the solar, the hydropower, because hydro is not always available, the water behind the dams, and forecast when those resources are available, use them when they're available, and then fill in the gaps with the other resources that we have. And when they're able to do that, that's how they're able to keep the prices low and keep the lights on. It's just really incredible work that they're able to do.
Well, and you bring up the regional aspect of it, and that's always fascinating to me. I had a boss years ago on Market to Market that used to say, you know, what seems to make sense on energy is what you do, what's best locally for you, because it's not an answer nationally. How much of that power that, say, I know it's outside your region, but in that Southwest, in the Plains area where it's all wind, how much of that stays in that region? And then how much is shipped across the country? And is that the goal of a national system?
Yeah, it's hard to answer that question. So electrons actually don't physically stay close to where they're generated. And it's hard. I'm not an engineer. I really prefer to stick to the work in the legislatures and the regulatory bodies. But the engineers have told me this, that electrons will flow wherever there's copper or wherever there's a conductor that they're able to be energized. And so effectively, the power will flow wherever it's able to. And so with the winter storm that we had during Christmas, there was power that was being produced in Canada that was able to help folks in places like Georgia. And so by being better connected with our neighbors, it was able to help keep the lights on in places that needed the power, because we were seeing places like the Tennessee Valley Authority and Duke Energy over in the Carolinas, they had blackouts during the winter storm. Because they were having difficulty with coal power and natural gas units being able to keep the lights on. And during that storm, it was really important for MISO and for the Southwestern Power Pool to be able to be connected to our neighbors through these large-scale transmission lines to be able to ship power to our neighbors. And so while it's great to have local resources available so that you can have those nearby, sometimes it's equally important to have resources from our neighbors so that we can borrow them in emergency situations like the winter storm that we just had.
The old cup of sugar. I need a cup of electricity.
That's exactly right.
That's exactly what it is. And I said the word national grid. What does that mean? And what's that reaction evoke in you when you, because you're talking about something that sounds like that?
Sort of. So there's technically three grids. there's the Eastern Interconnection, there's the Western Interconnection, and then there's Texas.
Yeah. I knew that's where, that was the punchline of the joke.
Yeah.
And then there's Texas. Yeah.
There's a little bit of a nuance to Texas. Texas is technically got some bit of a connection with the Eastern Interconnect, but that's for another story. But
yes,
by and large, the Eastern Interconnection is the Rocky Mountains and east, and then you've got the Western Interconnect, which is the Rocky Mountains and west, and then you've got this grid system within Texas, which is almost entirely isolated into itself. And it's the grid system is these very large scale transmission lines that are sort of connected to each other to varying degrees. And so for folks that don't deal with this work an awful lot, the best way to kind of think about it, and I think I've talked about this before, is to think about a tree with its roots, its trunk, and its branches, where if you have power plants that act as roots to be able to provide power, you have all of those connected to the trunk, which can be large-scale transmission lines. And then those transmission lines are then connected to smaller scale distribution lines, which are the lines that you see in your neighborhood. And so those neighborhood power lines are the things that provide electricity to your house, to your businesses, to smaller scale customers. But it's really those trunks, those large scale transmission lines, that's what we mean when we talk about the grid, the large scale infrastructure that connects one major utility to another, one state to another, very large infrastructure that carries billions of kilowatt hours across multiple jurisdictions in order to ensure that the power stays on.
Okay. So when you say some of those phrases, they elicit a whole line of questions for me. So forgive me for a minute, Simon, if I go crazy for a minute. One of the biggest stories that I think we're going to talk about in 23, maybe you'll agree, is that being able to tap into the grid anywhere, anytime with more demands for electricity, whether it's another six phones or it's that electric car. That's one of those. When you hear this whole, the grid can't handle that electric car you plugging into your house at night, what's your reaction?
Well, so I have an electric car. The thing about the grid and electric use and electric cars is you don't always use the same amount of power at the exact same time during the day. And so for us, for my family, we use our electric car during the day. We drive during the day. And so when we park the car at night, and I think most folks park their car in the garage at night, it's sitting there for 8, 10, 12 hours overnight. And that's the perfect time to charge a car. And so that's when we charge our car. Well, that also happens to be the time when electric power usage tends to be slack or less than normal. So electric companies know this. The grid operators, MISO, SPP, the other grid operators, they know this. And so you can go on their websites. You can go to misoenergy.org and spp.org and go to their websites and look at the charts of the power demands for those regions right now in real time. It's incredible the amount of data that you can see there. But you can see that the power demands for the regions really drop down pretty significantly at night. And so what the grid operators do is they literally tell the utilities, stop generating so much power. We do not need this much power at night because there's no need for it. We have plenty of power plants because those power plants do have to ramp up during the afternoons, but they're lying around unused at night. Well, if you happen to increase the usage of power at night with electric cars, you all of a sudden have a new need for more power at night. And remember what I said earlier, wind generates very well at night. And so there have been situations where wind generation, in fact, gets turned off, curtailed, because there's too much of it at night. And so wind generators would absolutely love to be able to build more farms, generate power to help folks charge their electric cars at night. And I've got a wild story to tell you. So when we lived in Texas, you get to pick and choose your electric providers in Texas. And in Texas, we were on an electric rate plan that we got free power at night, 0 cents per kilowatt hour at night, specifically because they had so much wind power that they were actually having negative power prices at night. And so it was actually cheaper for our electric company to give it away for free as opposed to trying to sell it off at a negative price. And so it was our power prices were higher in the afternoons, of course, so that way the utility could make money. But because our power prices were free at night from 9 p.m. to 9 a.m., that's when we charged our electric car. So we drove that electric car, no joke, for 30,000 miles for free because that's when we charged our electric car.
And you could probably, I mean, I assume it's this way in many other parts of the country as it is here. The power companies here will tell us during my news time, it was in the heat of summer or the peak cold of winter, it would be, save those big, heavy, hot activities at night. Don't strain our grid during the day. Wash your clothes, dry your clothes, whatever it is at night. And that to me sounds like we already had that plan in place. It's just now we have to adjust. It's now electric cars that are going to be running more at night.
That's absolutely right. So as a consumer, we had the choice to pick and choose our rate plan in Texas. And so we chose to go on that rate plan. You didn't have to choose that plan. We chose to do that. But when we chose to do that, we intentionally did our laundry at night. We did our dishes at night. We automatically set our dishwasher to go then. We had our electric water heater on a timer so that it would go, so it would automatically turn on at night. We didn't tell any difference. We had a thermostat that would change the temperature at night. So that during the winter time, it would get nice and toasty during the night and pre-warm the house mm-hmm. at night. And during the summertime, it would pre-cool the house in the morning. And so our electric bills were actually about $40 a month because we were able to shift so much of our power demand to that nighttime hour. And I was living and working at home. And so it wasn't an inconvenience, and we were saving an awful lot of money by being able to pick and choose our power provider and being able to shift our load like that. Now, not everybody has a rate plan like that so that you can pick and choose when your power is being used like that. And that's where, you know, home batteries are going to become popular. And so it's really important for folks to check with your power provider first mm-hmm. To see if that's something available to you. It's something called a time of use rate.
Were you in a major metro area of Texas where that was?
Yeah, we were in Fort Worth.
Okay.
And then we're here in Little Rock. We do have a time of use rate here in Little Rock with our energy provider as well. It's not as good as what it was in Fort Worth. But we do have a time of use rate here as well, where it is a little bit cheaper at night than what it is in the afternoon during the summertime.
All right. You and I have danced around the battery issue. I want to get back to that. You just mentioned it. How prevalent, what kind of batteries are we talking, and how soon before you think that we're all going to have a battery in our house that is capable of doing things that we need it to do?
Yeah, I don't think batteries in your home are necessarily for everyone. So we crunched the numbers over in Texas to try and figure out because we were paying $40 a month for our own electric bill, and it really wasn't quite penciling out to add our own battery or in our own home, because at the time it was going to cost about $10,000 to put a battery in our garage. And you know, if you're saving $40 a month on a $10,000 investment, it's really not going to pay for itself. But the one thing we didn't calculate or add into our math there was the blackout that happened, because we were there during the blackout. And so it would have been really helpful to have a battery in our house during that blackout. And so it's a matter of what sort of benefits you want to take into consideration when you're adding these batteries into your household. Do you want to have the ability to go off grid temporarily if you have significant power outages for prolonged periods of times? And so, you know, looking back, would we have added a battery knowing what we know now? You know, maybe we would have. Because again, we could have charged the battery at night for free and then been able to use it throughout the day regularly. But they're not for everyone. They are particularly helpful if you pair them with solar on your rooftop. But for work purposes, we focus on very large scale batteries where they're pairing up with these large scale solar facilities. And when you pair the battery resources with large-scale solar facilities, that's where things really start to get interesting from a grid perspective. Because now, all of a sudden, you're able to operate solar facilities much more like a unit that you can dispatch like a gas plant or a coal plant, where you can turn them on and off whenever you want to. Because you're charging the battery from a portion of that solar facility that you're not really using at that time. And so it's a really helpful technology that it's growing quite quickly. And there's an interesting dynamic between the electric vehicle industry and the utility industry, where electric vehicles are going to be the first use for batteries, I'll say, that will drive the cost down very, very quickly, no pun intended. And because of that, that's where we're going to see significant cost reductions that will then lead into utility scale battery usage. And once we see those significant cost reductions, it'll make it even easier for homeowners to start adding batteries into their own homes.
Well, do you see the individual consumer's price or cost going down being a bigger driver than, say, an industry or a business's cost going down on a switch to more renewables in driving the battery industry?
It's hard to say. So, we've had a number of household prices for solar for our own home come give us quotes for us. And the prices that we're getting today for our own household are where utility scale solar was maybe about 5 years ago. And that is a significant drop in prices. We've seen utility scale solar prices in the $30 per megawatt range or 3 cent per kilowatt hour range. And to give you a sense, natural gas prices today are roughly in the, you know, call it 5 to 8 cents per kilowatt hour just to buy the fuel, depending on the price of natural gas. And so if you're able to turn off a natural gas power plant temporarily and use solar or wind instead, you're saving about twice as much by using that other resource. And so for your typical homeowner, it's still cheaper to buy from the grid, at least for now. And again, not everybody is able to have rooftop solar because you've got folks that live in apartments, folks that are leasing. And so it's still important to be able to use power from the grid. But I'll tell you, if you can invest in solar on your rooftop, it doesn't hurt to get a quote. It's very similar to any other home renovation project that you would get, you know, if you're adding a sunroom or if you're adding, you know, some other type of renovation to your house. You call up a few contractors, get a few prices. It's usually free. And if you're not satisfied with it, you don't move forward with it. So it doesn't hurt to ask.
Big picture. Have we built our last coal firing plant in the United States?
Yes.
Have we built our last natural gas energy powered plant?
I don't think so. And it's natural gas. It's hard to say what all is going to happen. Texas is going to build a natural gas plant here. They just approved a new one a few weeks ago. Natural gas is working on being able to co-blend with hydrogen. And the ability to switch over a natural gas facility to be able to burn hydrogen, at least in the future, is going to be a really important thing to pay attention to and watch. Because the ability to create hydrogen from renewable energy resources is going to be a game changer. The ability to have fuel on site or through pipelines and be able to store that energy nearby is going to be helpful. And so it's hard to say when that technology is really going to show up, but we are starting to see many more natural gas turbines that can co-blend up to 30% from what I'm hearing with hydrogen.
As you look to 23 in the states that you serve there with your group, what do you see as what state is something that the rest of us in the country should watch to pay attention that might be a leader, might be something of interest of they're trying something way out of the box, or somebody that's kind of finally catching up to the rest of the country?
Yeah, so there's a couple of states that I think are really quite interesting. So Louisiana is going to be a very interesting state. We're already seeing thousands of megawatts of projects being proposed in the state, both wind projects, but we're also starting to see the beginnings of offshore wind projects in the Gulf of Mexico. And that's going to be very exciting. It's going to take a little bit longer for those projects to get started, but the offshore wind industry is going to be sort of the way the oil and gas industry is going to evolve its maritime expertise in the Gulf of Mexico. And the expertise and the knowledge in the Gulf is perfectly suited to work in the offshore wind industry. Europe has been working in the offshore wind industry for something like 30 years, and the expertise in the oil and gas industry has been exceptionally helpful for the offshore wind industry. So being able to work with the oil and gas industry in Louisiana is going to be exceptionally helpful over the next couple of decades. And Louisiana is going to help lead that progress. Another state to watch is going to be Georgia. So in Georgia, we've got a number of projects that are going to move forward. There's a handful of solar developments that are going to happen in that state. There's also going to be a 500 megawatt battery procurement that's going to happen in that state next year as well. And it's going to be one of the most advanced developments of some of these advanced technologies in the Southeast, if not the rest of the country. And so, again, these are states that don't have mandates. It's happening because the utilities and the regulators in these states know that renewable resources help diversify the energy available and also help keep the costs low for the customers.
The old free market at work again.
Yeah.
All right, Simon, I appreciate it. A great insight today. Thank you for filling things in, and always fun to find out what goes on around in the country. And then we'll spend the next, we'll do this again, but we'll spend 90 minutes just talking Texas energy.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Simon, thank you so much.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks, Paul.
My thanks to Simon Mahan. Very interesting. Kind of stimulates the brain there, gives me something to think about. We did keep talking after we stopped recording and learned a little bit more about some of those energy plans, and maybe there'll be future episodes of the MTOM podcast. Check back every Tuesday to see what we think of next. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.